Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 91st episode of the Mander Podcast. I'm your co-host, Roger Bodie, joined as always with my best friend and other co-host, Michael Hamilton. Michael, how often do you get a haircut or do you cut your hair?
Probably a few times a year. I don't know.
You don't have like a set schedule. It's not like, oh, it's the first of the month time to go get a trim.
No, it's just my hair is getting too long. It's bugging me. Time to cut it off.
That's fair. That's kind of how I am. My hair, I'm looking a little shaggy up here. But I haven't made time to get a haircut. I need to. But I'm leaving for a flight into the Virgin Islands on Thursday morning. So I have to somehow squeeze it in tomorrow. And tomorrow's already a very busy day. So I don't know when I'm going to get my hair cut. Maybe I should stop doing this podcast and just go get my hair cut real quick. Can I get my – I go get a haircut with my travel mic and do the podcast while I'm getting my hair cut? Think they'd be okay with that?
I don't think we can make that work.
Hmm. But if I cut my – I could see myself. I could just go snippy-snip. Snip.
You could cut your own hair, especially if you just like shave it all off. Then it's real pretty easy to cut your own
hair. Just go. Zoom, zoom. I gotta keep my flowing locks while they're growing. This majestic, coiffed hair doesn't just. You'd be a waste to deprive the world of all this, Michael. Of all this.
If you say so, buddy.
It'd be a waste. I was a long time before I started styling my hair. I think I was like 27, 28, somewhere in that range before I started like actually doing anything with my hair. Before that, it was just all the time. It was just this all the time.
Looks like you just got out of the shower.
I know. That was me all the time. And then I was like, what if we just did this? And then eventually, I needed a bunch of product to do it. Mm-hmm. And then in time, you just train your hair. And then it just kind of does it naturally now.
Weird.
So this natural coif that's been built up over time, I got to keep it going.
Okay, I see. So you're going to the Virgin Island this weekend. I'm going to Vegas this weekend.
Yeah, you're going to go play a bunch of craps, right?
No, I'm going to go play Alpha Clash at the Realms Games Alpha Clash event. That's Clash.
And then after you win that, you're going to play a bunch of craps with Zach, right?
No. I think we're going to... We were talking about putting together an Alpha Clash draft beforehand, and that's going to be sick. I haven't gotten a draft Alpha Clash yet. I'm excited.
Oh, yeah, because I have limited product and all that stuff there, huh?
Yeah, the draft set came out. Actually, I think like a few months ago. We just haven't played
it. Done anything with it. Did you ever figure out like how like Clash buffs or anything, or how like the actual system works, or are you just going to go and figure it out there?
Nope, I don't know how it works. I sure know how Constructed works, though. I'm ready to play Constructed.
Yeah, but that's fair.
Yeah, I don't know how the limited format works. I'm going to be learning with probably a lot of the people there, and it'll be a good time.
I imagine drafting Alpha Clash sounds sweet because it's like Magic, where once again, you could just splash and you'll just have like, but you don't even have to worry about like putting, like you'll have to play more of your cards because you don't just get to add the basic resources in, but like it's not as going to be as crunching as drafting Flesh and Blood.
Yeah, I don't actually know deck sizes for Alpha Clash Limited or how many packs you draft. If you draft three, I think most of their packs are 10 card packs, but I guess the draft box might be different.
Yeah, I would assume so.
So I don't know. We'll see. I really don't know what I'm getting into, but I love Limited, so I'm sure it'll be a good time.
Okay. Well, hope you have a grand old time at the Realms big level up event sponsored by the Realm Gaming, hosted by the Realms, as demonstrated by the Realm Games in Ohio. So awesome company, that Realm Games, huh?
Yeah, they're pretty cool. Running a cool tournament. I'm excited.
If I were there, I would definitely go and buy lots of singles from the Realm Games and lots of gaming supplies like deck boxes and sleeves, and make sure that my deck was in tip-top shape for the upcoming Clash Ground at the Clash Ground Vegas Realm event.
Awesome.
Crushing the sponsorship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what are we talking about today?
I'm feeling sad.
Feeling a little blue?
I'm feeling a little blue. Oh, although this episode was your idea, so I think you're more blue than I am.
Yeah, I'm the one feeling blue. I really like feeling blue, though.
I'm a Bolton gamer, so I like feeling yellow, I guess. But that, I don't know. What does that mean? I just probably won't say it again.
Okay.
So if you're feeling blue, what's blue? What's blue with you?
So today we are talking about blue cards in honor of Mysteria, where the set is themed around blue cards. We want to talk about what makes blues good. They pitch for three, but what makes specific blues good? and what some examples of good blues are and why they're good, basically.
Okay. So what's your first example?
So first, I kind of want to go over blues in general. So blues, you put them in your deck because you want them to pitch for three resources so you can play cards most of the time. There's a few blues that are strong enough that you're actually putting them in your deck with the primary purpose of casting them. If you look at Passing Mirage and Dromai, you put it there mostly because you want to cast it. But for the most part, you're putting blues in your deck because you want to pitch them for three resources. And the reason that the quality of a blue when you're pitching it for three resources doesn't really matter that much, but the quality matters a lot when you need to do something else with the blue. Let's say you draw two blues and you have a hand that can only use one blue, or you draw a blue and your hand can't even spend the one blue of resources. So that's when the quality of blues come in. And then using them on defense also, you want blues ideally that block three. So if you have two blues and you want to block with one, then you'll have a three block that you can block, or you can block three with it. But when you're pitching blues and using them as resources, there's also situational things that care about the blue and require you to play specific blues. If you look at Titan's Fist and Anathos, you need blues that cost three or more to turn on your hammers to get their extra abilities. If you look at Harmonized Kodachi, you want your blues to cost zero so that your Kodachis can get go again. So there's a lot to think about when you're choosing what blues to put in your deck, I guess.
True. And some decks don't put any blues at all in their deck. And those are the red line builds, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Though I don't like those decks very much. I want some blues in my deck. Except Dromai. Dromai, you can convince me, but
that's fair.
Because your reds are good resource cards.
In preparing for this episode, I was looking at blue cards and I had a revelation. Not from a Sphinx, but it was just from a other source. But the blue block threes are really good. This is groundbreaking news. It really dawned on me because if you look at the opposite side of the corner on cards, that changes based on the pitch. So if a card attacks for four at red, it'll attack for three at yellow and then two at blue, the wounded blow or whatever, wounding blow. But the block value never changes there. There's no block three, block two, block one value on that. So that is never factored into the evaluation of the card's pitch, which is interesting.
Yep. Outside of cards that are basically only used for blocking, like defense reactions and block cards, the blues block just as well as the reds and the yellows.
I wonder if we'll ever see a card that scales, if it has a static attack value, it's not very good to attack with, but it's good to block with. It blocks for four, blocks for three, blocks for two. That'd be an interesting card. I should make Flesh and Blood cards.
This just sounds like a Sink Below that also can attack for one or something.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Or Brothers in Arms or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Where the ability to pump it pumps the block value more.
Yeah, something.
Higher, at different colors.
The point is, there's lots of cool things you could do with it, but more so as the cards currently sit, they're not factored into it. So usually the best rate when you're getting a blue of a card is that the three block on it when you're playing the three blocks. And that really makes the blue two blocks a lot worse in my mind, because you can always be getting a higher value or more rate out of your cards usually than two playing it or casting it, especially at the higher pitch cost. But that's just not the case for blues.
Yeah, I think ultimately when you're looking at a constructed deck, you're looking to get somewhere between 3 and 4 points of value per card. Higher than three, a good limited deck's getting about 3 points of value per card. A good constructed deck's probably getting pretty close to 4 points of value per card. But if you look at duplicate blues, if you have two blues in a hand, it's going to be really hard to get 4 points of value out of a blue on offense. It's just blues aren't statted like that. So getting 3 points of value on defense, that's that's pretty close. That's not bad. Three points of value, and it doesn't cost an action point. You just block with it. So that is, I think, a big part of why blue block threes are so good, because your primary purpose of blues is you want to pitch them for three resources, but you're going to have a lot of hands when you have a blue that you don't need to pitch for resources. And if it blocks three, then you're able to convert that card into 3 points of value.
Yeah. And that also makes, kind of explains why decks like Guardians or Icelander or the decks that have been so blue heavy have been so consistent as well, because their floor is kind of set by the baseline of their blues just being able to block a bunch, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we can kind of jump into each of these heroes, but I think a big part of why Guardians have been good is they get access to very good blues. A lot of their blues block for three, and their hands when they draw too many blues are usually pretty functional. So they get to play a really high blue count. They rarely have turns where they just don't have a resource card because they get to play so many blues.
Yeah, absolutely. And usually then their weapons usually cost a blue, and then usually you're allowed to then turn your blues into 4 points of fit damage on offense then as well. So then that is something that not a lot of classes have the ability to do as well. It's just getting 4 points of value out of a blue, just even pitching it, is just like very hard for a lot of classes to do.
Yeah. And I think if we look back at US Nationals last year, where Charles Dunn won with his very, very fatigue-y Briar, his like just value Briar, where it was playing a high blue count, a bunch of 3 for 7s. It was playing Grasp of the Arknight with Reaping Blade. It could also convert its blue into 4 points of value on offense at the cost of its action point, of course, but you pitch a blue, activate Grasp of the Arknight, and attack with your weapon for a 3+1 arcane.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the Guardians don't get an action point for their blue either, but...
Yeah. It costs the Guardians the action point, too. I would say you're getting kind of 3 points of value out of your resource card and then 1 point of value from your action point, roughly. Because I think action points are kind of valued at one, roughly.
Yeah. Depends on a lot of things, though.
They're kind of priced at two, but valued at one. It's weird.
Yeah. Sometimes they're worth zero. Sometimes they're worth infinity. They scale a lot.
Sure.
As we learned a lot in Heavy Hitters Limited, we're like agility tokens, right? Like sometimes your agility token was worth a lot of resources and value playing your extra card, and then sometimes it wasn't worth anything because you just couldn't make any value out of it, right? That's kind of what I was getting at.
Sure. That makes sense.
So what are some bad blues? What's like the worst blue in your mind?
So since blue's primary function is to pitch them for resources, it's hard to have a blue that's completely unplayable in some limited decks. Like most limited decks, like a lot of limited decks don't care what their worst blue is. They just need one more blue, and they'll take literally just essentially a blue card that doesn't block and doesn't do anything. So that is probably what the worst blue could be, a blue that doesn't block and doesn't do anything. We have had...
I'm scared now when you say that, because I'm like, I feel like every card out of that's been spoiled for the transcendent things have been cards that don't block and can potentially not do anything.
Yeah, that's true. That is, it is going to be interesting to figure out how to make these cards work, because on their face, they are like, if you don't, yeah, if you ignore the transcend part of them, the cards are like the worst blues we've seen.
Some of them, like, yeah.
One of them says shuffle. That's, I would argue that's generally worse for you than just not shuffling your deck, because you're getting to like, set up your second cycle when you're playing the game. You kind of control what your second cycle looks like. So shuffling, you're just randomizing it. And you're also diluting your first cycle by making it blue heavier, because all the blues that you've pitched are now getting shuffled back in.
That sounds like a good effect for me, since I'm so bad at remembering pitch stacks. I'd be like, oh, I perfectly had this memorized, but I had to play the shuffle.
Unlucky, battle. I had to shuffle.
Unlucky, well, I guess, like, but I transcend now. Ooh.
You would have liked Belittle chain. You just shuffle your deck, start remembering your pitch deck, and you're like, oh, a Belittle. Oh, well.
Or Katsu. Maybe I should be a Katsu gamer this whole time.
Yeah, you don't have to memorize your pitch deck with Katsu very often, because his hero power triggers so often.
Yeah. So anyways.
So, yeah, I would say the worst blues are blues that don't block well and are hard to get value out of playing on your turn. because then the only thing you're really looking to do with them is pitch them for three resources, and every blue does that. So for a blue to be better, it needs to be doing something, either getting you a benefit when you pitch it. Like if you look at the fables, like Heart of Fyandal, and what's the op 2 one called?
Eye of Ophidia.
These are blues that only pitch. That's all they do, but they have pretty nice upsides when you do pitch them. Arknight Shard as well. So weirdly, if you took away the text on them, they would be the worst blues in the game.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's actually why I got away from Heart of Fyandal and a lot of my Guardian decks, was because if you're ahead on life, then it's the worst blue in the game.
Agreed. And I think they've gone away from like those blue gems anyways, because maybe the blue gems are just like a little too good and consistent. I think the last blue gen was the one that made Seismic Surge tokens, right? And since then, they're either been yellow, red, or like a location.
Yeah, we'll see. I think that, I'm not sure if that's
what
like
color is the gear?
The gear is a yellow, the master
gear. The yellow, okay, because I thought the gear was unplayable, but I didn't know maybe they made the gear blue since it's so bad, but I guess it's still also a yellow.
I think if it was a blue, it would be pretty good. At least you'd always play it in max. And you'd probably play it in Dio as well. Maybe not. It'd be hard to compare with the blue items, I guess, where you have limited space for blue no blocks in your dash IO decks.
And to be fair, in the early days of this podcast, we did a lot of ranting and raving about fables and that if they were ever good, it'd be a big problem. And boy, howdy, did they take that message to heart, and they have not made any good fables ever since. There's been like... not a one that's been like even I guess Plague High was like sometimes maybe you could sort of think about it, but even then it's like okay.
Yeah, Plague High is probably the best fable from the in a while, but
the Light of Soul one I guess sees some play in Prism sometimes, but it's not a Bolton card, it's basically a Prism exclusive.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's true. That card is pretty good in Prism because you're like wanting to be pitching a yellow so often, and when you hit, it's like very, very good, especially if it's a Herald that you're putting in your soul.
Yeah. So I guess that one are Plague Hive. So they haven't been like atrocious, I guess. Maybe I should be giving them more credit. What was the one from... Oh, the Heavy Hitters was the Death Matcher.
Yeah, that one's not geared at Constructed. It feels like... Honestly, when I saw that card, I'm like, this feels like an optional rule to just like play with your... Ultimate Pit Fight games. Like, you wouldn't put it in your deck, you'd just be like, we all agree that the arena starts in play.
Yeah, I think that's how most people like view it as well. So is two a rate that you're happy to get off of your blues, like when you're actually casting them? Because I feel like that's kind of the ceiling we see for like a lot of blues that have been like playable or seen a lot of play in the past. I think the biggest examples that are sticking out in my mind are like Shred in Assassins, being able to shrink the 2 points of value when you cast them on the blocking card on the assassin attack, and then hopefully pushing it on hit. And then if you look back to like decks like Fi or the Ninjas, where you want your combo cards to at least attack for two, and there's a handful of them in the game that do actually have that two value, and sometimes you will attack with them.
Yeah, I think your blues attacking for two versus attacking for one with go again is function, like it's about getting the same value out of it. If you have like, you might just need action points, or you might need, you might need action points, or you might want a finisher depending on what your hand's lacking. So like one with go again and two, I would value it about the same thing. So I think like for your blues to be at rate, you'd want to be getting 4 points of value if it doesn't have go again, and 3 points of value if it does, which that's really hard to get on a blue, you know? And I think that the blues in Katsu that are just combo cards to attack for two, block three, and are blues, you're mostly just playing these because you need your blues to be zero cost. You need a critical mass of combo cards for Flick Flack or Ancestral Harmony, or I guess it's mostly those two. And then it also helps turn on your bonds, like your blue Fluster Fist helped turn on bonds. So that's why you play those. And then 100 Winds has, not 100 Winds, Winds of Eternity has the ceiling of if you play after 100 wins, it gets plus two. So you're getting your 0/4. Dishonor, if you play it after Bonds of Ancestry, it gets to the plus two. So you're getting a 0/4, which is like an on-rate card. And when your blues are on-rate cards, you're pretty happy.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess going back to my original question, though, so what is the best blue in the game that gets like the best rate when you're doing it then?
It's hard to say the best blue in the game because like, I think there are some very powerful blues that take like support to get them to their ceiling. But the cards that I think of when I think of the best blues are like Rouse the Ancients and Awakening, I think are like two of the higher ceiling blues. These cards, basically, they don't do anything without their condition being met. But when their condition's met, they are reasonably above rate, even for a red. Like, so they're like conditional
three
blues.
Go again. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're conditional blues, but their ceiling is quite high, basically. So if you look at Awakening, this card's been banned. It's very, very good. Basically, if you're behind by five life and you play your blue Awakening and you Earth Fuse it, so you need to be both behind and have an Earth card to get full effect out of it, then you could go get Pulverize and make 10 Seismic Surges, and basically you're two-card pulverizing your opponent, which is quite good.
Checks out.
So I would say that you're basically getting 14 points out of a value out of two cards there. You need the Earth Fuse, so kind of three cards, but you're an Earth deck, so you can kind of seeds away whatever stupid Earth card you end up left with after your Earth Fuse.
Yeah, that's fair.
So I think two card 14 with the on hit that Pulverize has, very, very good. That's probably the highest ceiling blue that we've seen. Another one that
we're talking about, Magic Christmas Land combo card. I think this one hasn't seen a lot of play because it's Majestic chess piece is gone now. And the chess piece that's broken. But do you play with Sonata Arcanics?
Bloodsheath Skeletta.
Thank you. Because. Bloodsheath Skeletta is gone, but the Sonata Phantasmia card, where it's create extra enchant cards where X is six or greater, target hero discards three cards at random.
Yeah, so the natural play pattern of this card is you spend 12, or not the natural play pattern, the ideal play, like the ideal use, the high ceiling of this card is you spend 12 resources, you play this, you get six or enchants, and your opponent discards three cards. So that's basically five cards for 6 points of value, and your opponent loses three random cards. That's basically a two card six, but random cards, they're usually getting like, it can often leave their hand awkward because they don't get to choose which card they keep. So sometimes they get stuck with their bad card instead.
Okay. You're right. Awakening's still better. Even when the Christmas thing, this just said discard card. So I was like, oh, this card has to be great.
Yeah. But when you pair it with ways to cheat on resources like Bloodsheath Skeletta, then this card gets absurd. If you're able to pour like 40 resources into this, you're getting 20 rune chance and your opponent's discarding cards. So cheating on resources, quite good in many, many games, and Flesh and Blood, no exception. But I think this card, the ceiling on it's not actually that high where you're spending five cards for the six rune chance, your opponent discards three. It's just like, not bad for a hand of four blue, for five blues. Just how do you get a five card hand? Rouse the Ancients, another one that you need to be able to reel 14 or 13 power worth of cards in your hand when you play it. But if you do, you spend three resources and a card for seven with go again. So you're getting like 3.5 points of value per card and not spending your action point. So you get to leave your action point left over. And it also pairs extremely well with Anathos, who wants you to find ways to get an extra blue in your pitch zone. So with Anathos following it up, you're basically getting a three card 13 when you do the thing, which that's more than 4 points of value per card. They're pretty happy when you do that.
Yeah, absolutely. What about like specializations? Are there any like blue special Olympia? Obviously we've been talking about for a long time since he has those three copies of his specialization. Just that's basically like the whole reason to play that hero at the moment. But Riptide has his legendary ones. Are there any other like specializations that are like crazy pushed?
Yeah, I think Riptides and Olympias are probably the best. There are others that are quite powerful in their decks, but that's only because they synergize really well with what the heroes are doing. Whereas like,
yeah, like Dishonor or something like that, where it's like,
yeah, I think Knock the Death Whistle is another example where it just synergizes with Azalea so well. You put your red in the ledger, which is another Azalea specialization on top, and then you use Azalea's hero power to load it with Dominate, and having Knock the Death Whistle with Dominate is very good. It's very good. It's specifically synergistic with this, like, is what you're trying to be doing. It often is worth more than just a random 1 for 5, which is what Red in the Ledger is. Because it synergizes so well with Azalea's card pool and her hero power, I'd say Knock the Death Whistle is a card that you're often getting a bunch of value out of.
Yeah, that's fair.
Become the Arknight, another good one. Where,
ooh, that's a classic.
Viscerai, spending 2 cards to get any card in your deck, usually not a good deal. Not something you want to be doing very often. There's usually not cards that are that much better than your other card that it's worth giving up 2 cards to go get it. But there's a couple of things going on with Viscerai where it makes it better than normal. Where some hands, a specific card is worth significantly more than it would be in other hands. Where, like, if you play a Morgitide in an attack action, your Revel and Runeblood is now worth 7. So, versus on any other turn where you play a non-attack and attack, it's worth 5. So it's getting +2 there. And then because of Viscerai's hero power, where you want to both start your turn with a non-attack action and you want to play lots of cards in your turn, being able to play Become the Arknight, it counts as a non-attack to turn on his ability, and it also is generating that rune chant if it's like your second or third thing you play, or it makes it so your other cards generate a rune chant.
Mm-hmm.
So, Become the Arknight. Also, Blocks 3, as we talked about before. Classic. If you don't want a 2-for-1 yourself by playing Become the Arknight and getting the upside that you get from also playing it, it's a blue. You can pitch it for 3. It also blocks 3. It just does all 3 things well. Knock the Death Whistle is also a block 3. So when you're not pitching it or playing it, you can also block for 3 with it. Another blue that's really, really powerful but synergistic, I think, is Terra Sunder, where it specifically combines really nicely with Anothos, where you're getting 3 cards for 7 dominates. On hit, they discard 2. So a lot of the time you're getting a 1 card plus your action point for 7 points of value there.
Yeah. So I will say there is an ice-sized hole in this conversation so far, and I'm surprised that you haven't said cards like Hypothermia, Blizzard, or Channel Lake Frigid yet.
You haven't even said what I think is the strongest one.
Oh, well, look at that. There's even a bigger hole, but what about these?
So first, I think Icelander is kind of special. She's like, her whole hero design is around blues and making blues better by being able to play them on your opponent's turn and give your opponent a frostbite when you play them. I think Hypothermia specifically is a card that's just like, it's like playable, but being able to instant speed it is what made it really problematic. I don't think Hypothermia is actually like that strong of a card. It just synergizes so well with Icelander. But a card that I do think is extremely strong is Insidious Chill.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I think that's one of the best blues in the game. It only blocks 2, so that kind of keeps it from being the perfect blue. But when you play this card early in the game, or any time in the game where you'll be able to ice fuse 3 times throughout the course of the game, you're basically spending a card and an action point for 3 cards from your opponent, because your opponent is so rarely going to be able to use their cards efficiently on your turn. So when you ice fuse on your turn, you just basically make them pay 2 or discard a card. If you're ice fusing with arcane damage, which Icelander was a lot of the time, if your opponent has a blue that they're happy to pitch to it, they can AB1, but it takes away, like, they don't have as much choice in that. Maybe like they have a blue, but they didn't really want to spend on Arcane Barrier because they want to spend it to do things on their turn. Well, Insidious Chill's either getting a full card of value, or you're getting, or the trigger's getting a full card of value, or now you're like making your opponent's hand worse by forcing them to spend their blue, basically.
Yeah. To be fair, all those cards saw a lot of play and were good before. I guess not all those cards, but I guess I'm thinking of Channel Lake Frigid in particular, was kind of a staple of the format while it was around, right? Old Eim still played it for a long time. Well, he had Winner's Whale, because then it was the classic play channel, like Frigid, pitching a non-ice card and then pitch the ice card to your Winner's Whale.
So Oldheim did play Channel Lake Frigid, but mostly it wasn't even to cast your Channel Lake Frigid. It's because it was a blue ice card that had a three in the bottom right corner. He also always played three copies of Winner's Grasp while he had Winner's Whale, because it was a blue ice card that blocked three.
Yeah, and true.
I think Channel Lake Frigid was better to cast. You did end up casting Channel Lake Frigid sometimes in Oldheim. It came up a lot against Pistol Dashes, where like you get to second cycle and you'd play out Channel Lake Frigid and it would buy you enough time to end up winning the Fatigue War. Sometimes, not that often, but it did come up.
Sure.
And ultimately, it was really broken because of Isander's hero power, where you could play on your opponent's turn, and then you'd basically get a whole extra turn of taxing them from it without having to pay the flow counter for that turn. So normally, if you play Channel Life Frigid on your turn, you're going to end your turn. It's going to get a flow counter on it. Then your opponent plays their turn, and then you have to pinch two ice cards to keep it around for a second turn. But Icelander broke that, where she would play on your opponent's turn. It would last the rest of that turn. Then she'd go to her turn. She'd pinch her one ice card, and then it'd get its first flow counter, and then it'd last the whole extra turn. So that, I think Channel Lake Frigid mostly really powerful because heroes cared about having ice, and it said ice and block three on it. But in Icelander specifically, she really kind of pushed this card.
That's fair. Okay. Yeah, I guess Icelander did take all these cards to the next level, so they're not as egregiously powerful as people maybe remember or give them credit for back in their time.
Yeah, I think it's mostly that Icelander's hero power was just like quite powerful, really good. And they did give a lot of really good ice blues that like you weren't unhappy to play. And Waning Moon was also a very powerful card. Basically, two resources for three arcane damage is a really good rate, especially when you're choosing which card you want to be casting on your opponent's turn. Your hero power so consistently lets you do it. Or
your one cost ice cards from Arsenal replace themselves, and then they have two floating resources and the Waning Moon.
Yeah. It just played so nicely. You cast your Polar Blast or your Cold Snap, pitching a blue. You got two floating for the Waning Moon. You trigger your Icelander hero power. It just was all a very synergistic pile of things to do together.
Yeah. Miss Icelander. That's why I'm going to win all my tournaments in Living Legend with Icelander. She's not dead. She's not gone. I'm going to prove it.
Yeah, I think Frost Hex was a card too that was, most of the time, it was a blue ice card that blocked for three. Right. But
blue block three is good. Confirmed.
But situationally, when you're playing against decks that were trying to fatigue you or take the game really long, it suddenly became your best card because you would play these Frost Hexes, you would combine them with Ice Eternal, but the Frost Hexes would get chip damage in when you gave your opponent Frostbite that they weren't going to use. They were just trying to block out fatigue you, or they weren't going to spend resources to break. Or against Wizards is also pretty good because they can like dance around your Frostbites a lot of the time. And I guess Guardians too, even they would just play their one big action, then your Frostbite wouldn't do anything. So Frost Hex in these matchups, it just like was frequently worth quite a few points of value.
Yeah. 100%. So we haven't talked about my favorite blue yet, though.
What is your favorite blue?
It is a card that breaks the core tenets of Flesh and Blood.
You're going to have to give me more than that. There's a lot of cards that do that.
Where you are supposed to only have access to four cards in a given turn cycle. And this card says, "Nah, I'm going to chill around here and stay on the battlefield."
Energy potion.
It's energy potion. I love energy potion. I love energy potion so much.
Yeah, energy potion actually is weirdly one of my least favorite cards. I think it kind of fundamentally just like breaks like the value Flesh and Blood game that I like to play, where like you're spending your action point on a card for two resources later. That's such a bad deal. You can just pitch a card.
It's horrible. This is real bad.
Why would I want to spend a card and an action point for two? And it doesn't even block. You can't block with it. You either pitch it or you play it. So energy potion, just like in math fab, it's real bad. But when heroes can do broken things with two extra resources, if you can convert that to more than 4 points of value, then that's really good. That's really powerful. And a lot of the time, the decks that are looking to play energy potions, they they do have a way to convert it to more than four value.
You could convert it into like 50 value. It's sweet.
Yeah. I think the most common home for energy potion right now is Kano.
And right. Yeah.
Kano,
he plays all three.
Yeah. He plays three copies of it and he's looking to get his energy potions down so he can go Aether Wildfire into multiple spells. And without energy potion, it can be hard to have enough resources to do that. The energy potion can often be the difference between casting your Blazing Aether and not casting it, or casting a spell between your Wildfire and your Blazing Aether. And that's worth much more than
sometimes even just the two Metacarpus node activations, you know?
Sure, sure, yeah. Nodesing your Wildfire and the next spell. Which easily is worth more than four damage. If you nodes Wildfire and play two more spells after, with the last one being a Blazing, that's plus five damage. And then getting the nodes on the next spell is also plus two damage between that spell and the Blazing Aether. So turns your energy potion into 7 points of value. That's more than the four that it needs to be okay on the value math.
Yeah. And then I play one of in Saber's Bolton as well, because it lets you go pay one for Gallantry Gold, pay one for Via the Vanguard, and then Via the Vanguard with Spirit in play lets you then play your Luminous at instant speed, so then your Via the Vanguard is pumping all of your Sabers for the rest of the combat chain as well. So it's just a clean activation, or just by itself, just paying the two resources to activate Warband of Bellona, then hopefully that card that you're charging is a yellow card that then replaces itself for you to go and do other things on the turn.
Yeah, I think Energy Potion is, it definitely makes it a lot easier to triple Lumina. If you're keeping a five card hand with V, you can triple Lumina with Energy Potion.
Yeah, I think it's one of Pitch Deck Bolton's best cards.
It's one of Pitch Deck Kano's best cards.
Yeah, there you go.
these heroes that are trying to assemble things that are like much greater than the sum of their parts, Energy Potion can be one of these pieces.
Yeah, you know me. What do I like to do in card games? Assemble things that are more than the sum of their parts, and Energy Potion is usually one of those parts that's more than its base sum.
Yeah, and I think Energy Potion isn't the only potion that can do this. We saw Chain decks would play Time Snap Potion as a way to get six cards from Blood Debt played in a turn to be able to play your Eclipse to summon Urser and get an attack with the Urser. So it would be worth six damage if it was the difference between attacking and not attacking with Urser, and more than that if it was the difference between summoning and not summoning Urser.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they learned their lesson from like these Welcome to Wraith initial designs from the potions. There's also Potion of Strength and Crazy Brew, but those are much more marginal.
Yeah, it's
go ahead.
It's hard to make Potion of Strength worth more than the plus two it's giving, because
yeah,
it gives plus two power. Like, you need something that like doubles the amount of power and get from things that increase its power. I guess like Amplifying Arrow plus one's it. but that's still only 3 points of value. So.
Yeah, it's not great. But when they went to Everfest, they printed a lot more of these effects that can sit on the battlefield items. None of them are as good as Energy Potion or Time Snap Potion. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, I think the amulets actually are...
I can't even tell you what 3/4 of the amulets do still.
Sorry, the elemental amulets from Tales of Aria.
Oh, yeah, those ones are good.
I think those are a good example of...
But that was also pre-Everfest, so...
That was pre-Everfest. I think those are items that I really like. I think both Amulet of Ice and Amulet of Earth are quite good.
Amulet of Ice was banned. It was so good.
Yeah. Amulet of Lightning, not so good, though I did play it in quite a few of my limited Briar decks. And I was pretty happy because it would often be the difference between swinging and not swinging Rosetta Thorn, and my blue that I was playing earlier in the game to create like an embodiment of Lightning or do some or Lightning Fuse with or something. It ended up just like checking enough boxes to be pretty good.
Yeah, something, 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 action point, something, something, modular value, something, something.
Yeah, just like a blue that most time I drew it, I was still just using it as a resource card, but I was not unhappy when the hand wanted me to play it out either.
Yeah, fair enough. I think Lightning really got the short end of the stick looking back on things. It just like really didn't ever find a home or identity.
Like Amulet of Lightning or Lightning?
No, just like the Lightning talent. Like, there was never, like, there was Lightning Briar, and then they banned Ball Lightning, and then the deck died, and then that was it.
Yeah, I think it's hard for an element to do as well as it could when you ban its best card.
It's To be fair, I don't think Ball Lightning was necessarily the Lightning's best card. I think that card was just like a rules nightmare.
Sure. I do think Ball Lightning was...
I can't tell you how Ball Lightning stacks.
Ball Lightning was pretty strong. A lot of the time it was like a 0-for-5 or a 0-for-6, which is really, really powerful. 0-for-6, go again. It's a good deal.
It doesn't block.
It does not block. And it wasn't... It often wasn't a 0-for-5 or 0-for-6 either. If you're against a deck that wants to block you out anyway, they're like, oh, nice Ball Lightning. Here's my blue block 3.
Yeah, but then they would set up the unbeatable endgame of Sting Sting.
Stop.
You could never win.
No.
I love you, Brendan.
Anyway, we got here because of the amulets. I think we're all quite solid in their own ways. I think Amulet of Earth was probably the weirdest of them in terms of it wasn't like obvious when you should be playing it. And the fact that you don't really want it in Oldheim and Briar really wants these 3-block non-attack action blues because of her hero power meant that it saw less play than maybe it could have. But It still saw some play in some Briar decks. And it paired really nicely with Force of Nature, where your Earth fuses your Force of Nature and you're attacking. And now they have to overblock because you're threatening this Amulet of Earth activation. And then you just hold it for the next time you do it. And it was pretty powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
One more thing to look at with your blues when you're trying to find blues that are good is a lot of the time that you're going to be looking to play a blue or use a blue is a time when you'd be having multiple blues in your hand. So the worst case scenario is your blues are bad with other blues and your opponent just like maybe they block out your last turn, you draw a hand of 3 blues and your blues don't play nicely with each other. They don't do anything together. I talked about Rouse the Ancients and Terra Sunder, where these are both hands that you want 3 blues for. So you play your Rouse, you play your Terra, and then you attack with Anathos. And I think that's true in general. If you want blues that are good with multiple other blues, because you're probably not playing a blue if it's your only blue in your hand. You're probably just pitching it for your other cards. But when you have 3 blues in your hand, you really want to make sure that your blue does, that you have at least one of them is something that does something. I think that's why, not Showtime, Imposing Visage ended up being pretty good in Bravo, because you could play Imposing Visage when you had 3 blues and go get another blue and swing your hammer and arsenal your last card. Or you could get a red and pitch your 4th blue to swing your hammer and arsenal your last card. It only does something when you have 2 more other blues to go to pitch to it. But that's really what you need your blues to be doing. If you just have 1 blue, you're just going to be spending it to do something. It's when you have a lot of blues that you really need to be able to play a blue. I had another example, but I forgot it.
That's fine. I realized that I was also kind of biased in my evaluation here as well. And that there's another class that has really broken blues that we didn't talk about yet.
Another class.
Mm-hmm. One of the best blues in the game, even. It's like a repeatable energy potion every turn for 3 turns.
Oh, Mechanologist. Yes, yes. It's not 3 turns. You only get 2 turns out of your Teclacore.
2 turns. I know how Mechanologist cards work. I swear.
Yeah, I think both Teclocore and Teclopounder are both quite good blues because they're on rate when you play them, basically. Teclocore, you're spending an action point and a card for 4 resources. That's on rate. It's spread out over the next couple of turns, which can be pretty good if you can use them. It can set up like maximum velocities to be pretty strong, or you can use them with high octanes to like go above the sum of the parts, basically, to have like 5 2/3 card hands that are very strong. And then Teclopounder also is a blue item that you'll get 6 points out of. So when you spend 2 resources and a card, you're looking for 6 points of value. Red 2 costs give you 6 points of value. Usually you look at like Command and Conquer, you look at Brutal Assault at red, they're 6 points of value for 2 cost. And Teclopounder gives you that, and it's a blue. So I think those are actually 2 very good blues, and they were both on my potential top 10 list before we decided not to do a top 10 list of
what
blues.
About Evos? How do you rate Evos?
So
Teclo's been doing well now. He seems to be a real hero in this current metagame at the moment. He won a couple pro quests, but so did Riptide, I guess. So I don't know what's happening out there.
First, I'm not a Teclo believer in Constructed. I don't think he is good enough.
He won ProQuest, Michael. He has to be good enough.
Okay.
You know, if you win ProQuests, you're a tier one hero.
There's a lot of tier one heroes then. So the blues, though, if you do the math on them, they are pretty solid, costing 4 resources and a card, and then you get 6 points of value out of just the block value out of the card. So you're kind of going 2 below rate, because you'd expect to get 8 points of value if you're spending 4 resources a card and an action point. So you're getting 6, but it being armor where you can kind of like spend the blocks how you want, and then you also get these other things that are powered up by you having evos, it's pretty easy to make up that 2 points of value over the course of the game.
And they usually have abilities themselves too that are worth something usually.
Yeah. So I think the biggest problem I have with Teklovassin's evos is that the same problem that I've always had is that your base equipment is so bad. Because, yes, you're getting 6 points of value when you play a blue Evo over your Teklo base shoes or whatever. But the biggest problem is then you're playing Teklo base shoes instead of a good equipment. I guess that's not a good example because mech don't have access to good shoes. But if you're playing the chest piece or the hat instead of like Crown of Providence or Balance of Justice or Final Spring Tunic or Foundry Heart, Teklo Foundry Heart, you're just like going down 2 to 4 to 5 points of value in your loadout presentation. And even though these evos are about pretty close to being at rate, you are losing a lot of that value just before the game starts because you're presenting these base equipment.
Okay.
But yeah, that's fair. I think that's why we actually saw the slab dash decks play the evo shoes and the evo arms is Mechanologist shoes and arms, you couldn't really get more than 1 point of value out of them. There's just none that had more than 1 point.
Goliath Gauntlet, you could get 2 points of value.
Okay, Michael. Okay. That's true. You're right. You could get 2 points. But you can play the base that blocks for 1, and then you have these kind of powerful, not that powerful, but like close to at rates evos that you can play out. And you got a lot of value when you played them on turn 0 or something, or just like sometimes you're playing matchups where your opponent really struggles to use a 4-card hand. So being able to do something with extra cards on your turn to get value that doesn't allow your opponent to block, there's some value in that in some matchups too.
Sure. Okay. I just want to give some mechanologists some love for once.
Yeah, you were like, let's talk about a class with blues. And I'm like, oh no, I got nothing. I can't figure out who you're talking about.
There's one more blue that's been curious off our list so far.
Pulling up my blue list. Is it Warmonger's Diplomacy?
It's Warmonger's Diplomacy. We have not talked about that one. The most hated and reviled blue of all time. Ruining Azalea and making her an unplayable deck that can never win a calling ever again. All because Warmonger's Diplomacy exists. She's an unplayable tier 4 deck. Why did they print this card? Does anybody at LSS even read cards, Michael?
Well, it's actually kind of funny because Warmonger's Diplomacy did push Azalea out of the metagame. You shouldn't have played Azalea for a while. And then there was no Azalea and there was no Runeblades. And those are the heroes that Warmonger's Diplomacy was supposed to host. So people started cutting their Warmonger's Diplomacies, even from decks that like they naturally fit really well in. The Katsu that Brody played in the finals, I think it was Pudding. Was it Pudding? Okay. Only had 1 copy of Warmonger's Diplomacy in his list because they're just... the heroes that it was good against weren't showing up. And then when you aren't bringing Warmonger's Diplomacy, then suddenly the decks that are very vulnerable to it can do well. But overall, I think it is a very, very harsh, like punishing card to those strategies. I think that your blue block 3, it's like another situational blue block 3 where the ceiling of it's very good. Your opponent's turn sometimes gets like -8, -10 when you play Warmonger's Diplomacy. Sometimes even more against like some very nutty 5-card Azalea or Viscerai hands. Yeah, it's a very powerful card.
Yeah. And I remember at US Nationals last year, I was talking to Mr. Gottlieb and he was like, the problem with Warmonger's Diplomacy is there aren't enough effects like Warmonger's Diplomacy. There should be more Warmonger's Diplomacy effects. And then we saw in Heavy Hitters, the Warmonger Diplomacies 3 and 4 in like, or 2 and 3 with Ripple Away, Nasty Surprise. And they're nowhere near as good as Warmonger's Diplomacy. but they're there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Warmonger's Diplomacy is too good. I think Ripple Away and Nasty Surprise are much more toned back. Like Ripple Away, you can discard it. Maybe you'll prevent two or three tokens from it. I think you really need to prevent, like, its floor is a blue that blocks three. So you need to get more than three value out of the token preventing to have it make sense to discard it, which is pretty hard to do. Maybe an Azalea laces with Blood Rot and Infecting Shot. Now it's getting 4 points of value if you discard it. Maybe it's a premeditated one as well. Then you're getting seven value. There you go. You did it. But for the, it comes up sometimes where you're getting that value. And I think that's a good spot. I think Nasty Surprise, when your opponent makes you discard it, I think you get 3 points of value. You get three tokens.
You get Agility, Might, and Vigor.
Yeah, so three tokens, so roughly 3 points of value.
Yeah.
And
so when it's in your arsenal and your opponent command and conquers you, you can be like, aha, I still get three value out of my card. I did it.
Yeah, I think the main use is when your opponent codexes you and you have to discard the codex.
Sure, either way.
So
I always thought of it as a command and conquer card, but I guess it makes sense against codex as well.
Yeah, I think most often you just shouldn't be arsenaling it, so it shouldn't come up against Man and Conquer that often. But
yeah, that's fair.
But Pummel and Codex, discarding it's pretty good.
You know what the other big difference between these cards is and Warmonger's Diplomacy?
They don't stop your opponent from playing the game.
That, yeah. The two, they're also attacks, and attack actions have more consequences of negative blocking interactions between various heroes and situations than non-attack actions.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because when I was playing Bravo, part of including Warmonger's Diplomacy in my deck was, I played three copies of my Bravo deck pretty consistently. It was very good against Azalea and the Runeblades, but also against Bolton and the Assassins. I just wanted a non-attack action that I could sideboard in to block more effectively in those matchups. And I said non-attack, I said block three, it was blue. Checked all the boxes, it went in the deck.
Yeah. I think the reason why... I was going to say the reason why Warmonger's Diplomacy might be a non-attack action is so that you can't loop it, but you can loop it. If you just name peace, you can then go to your next Warmonger's Diplomacy and your next turn keep playing more Warmonger's Diplomacy. That doesn't even make sense, so never mind.
Yeah, it also doesn't really make sense as an attack. What would it, like, how would it work as an attack?
It would be all the exact same text, but you'd just be like a zero. It'd be like Nasty Surprise. So it'd be like a two cost attack. And as his attack against your opponent,
you name war. Everyone names war or peace, regardless of whether it hits or not. It just happens when you attack with it.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be really weird to attack you with a thing and say, I'm choosing peace. I'm hitting you as I choose peace.
This is a peaceful attack.
Maybe an instant, honestly. No,
it's also kind of a flavor fail when you're a wizard and you name peace and you're like, I'm peacefully sending magic missiles at your face. This is so peaceful. Take this damage.
That's true. But Warmonger's Diplomacy, really strong card. I would recommend including three in your Katsu decks with after Azalea Went a Calling, and it's probably on the rise.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
All right, I'm out. I'm out of thoughts.
You're done? We covered all the blues?
No, we did not cover all the blues. There's a lot of blues. We didn't talk about what makes blues bad that much. Two blocks that you don't want to play. Pretty bad.
What about we forgot about the best one. Your real favorite blue. Lunging Press. All-Star. Your favorite card in the whole game.
No. So Lunging Press kind of sucks because it blocks two, and the reaction of it getting the plus one, it has to be the difference between pushing an on hit over and not to be reasonable. And if it's pushing an on hit over, the on hit needs to be worth at least two to even make up for the value of a card. So if you have a lot of on hits that are worth three and your opponent's playing a deck that wants to exactly block, Lunging Press is all right. It's definitely better than it used to be because Crown of Seeds is gone. I think when Crown of Seeds was around, it was especially bad because you would attack with your three power with an on hit or your four power with an on hit. They'd be like, sink below. And then you're like, Lunging Press, and they're like, Crown of Seeds.
Yeah. But I'm just surprised it doesn't see more play with Command and Conquer, because then, you know, you could lunging press your Command and Conquer, and your opponent, oh, he's just going to block for six, and they can't even defense reaction it. It's just over. You get their arsenal. What happens when you attack with this and this combo lines up and they don't have an arsenal?
You pitch it. Well, the
yeah, there you go. Perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. I think lunging press is pretty good design. It's a low floor, reasonably medium to high ceiling blue. So like it can often be worth a card when you play it on offense, a card and an on hit that's worth a card, like a snatch. You're getting plus one plus an on hit from snatch. That's pretty good. And I think I like the power level of lunging press. I think like it's good design, even though I think it's not the strongest card in the world. It is a well designed card.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's probably why they reprinted it, because it was a sweet card.
It is a sweet card. So you're all done. That was your final. No more final thoughts on blues then.
I like blues.
They're good. They do a lot of things, in that using your blues well and using your blues not well is usually the difference between winning a lot of games in Flesh and Blood.
One more closing thought, actually. I got my closing thought. So
sure.
When you're looking at building decks, a lot of the time you look at the curve of your deck and you're like, man, this deck wants this number of blues. And that's not really how you should be looking at it, because you can play a lot more blues if your blues are better, because better blues means that your cost of drawing multiple blues together is lower. So if you have a deck that all the blues are horrible, like when I was looking at Dorinthia decks, I was like, man, all these blues are so bad, I can't play enough blues and be happy with my blues. Then it was really frustrating. But when your blues are good, you can play more. And that's why a lot of white guardians get to play more blues, is because they have Rousey Ancients, they have Terra Sunder, they have these blues that are very impactful and make it so when you draw three blues together, your hands still work really well, on top of just having things that cost a lot of resources.
Fair enough. Well, the next time you're using Lunging Press to push over your crush effects after your opponent blocks for taking 3 damage, always remember, mind your manners.